Hey, you ever wonder why water is wet? Well, the answer is a lot more complicated than you think. I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason can never teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the less likely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain its origin. The really amazing thing is that quantum physics shows that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and knowledge in ways biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. Have you ever heard of a Boltzmann brain? Well, it's named for an Austrian physicist named Ludwig Boltzmann, who is really best known for helping us understand the atomic background to what is known as entropy, or disorder in nature. I mean, did you ever wonder why you could see eggs splatter? But I bet you never one time ever saw a splattered egg come back together again. Boltzmann helps explain that. You ever wonder why if you mix cream and tea, they mix together, but you'll never get the cream out of the tea again? Boltzmann explained that. You ever wonder why if perfume leaves a bottle, good luck in ever trying to get the smell back in? Or, to make it even a little simpler, you ever wonder why it's so much easier for your room to stay messy than for it to stay clean? Well, Boltzmann helped explain the why of all this. Basically, he showed that the natural tendency of things is towards disorder because there's so many more ways that atoms, the atomic structure of things, can be in disorder than in perfect order. It's kind of like a deck of cards. There's a whole bunch more ways you could have them out of order than have them in the one perfect order. But anyway, this is the foundation of one of the most, known as the second law of thermodynamics. And Boltzmann was the one who really helped us understand what that all means. Okay, that's Ludwig Boltzmann. Okay, but what is a Boltzmann brain? Now, that's another matter entirely. You know, but anyway, it's based on his argument, on the argument that things get very disorderly over time. You got the question, why do we have so much order in our neck of the woods? So orderly, in fact, that we could even have life, and even more mysterious than life is human consciousness. Now, this argument, purely theoretical, is that amid all this order, there are certain random fluctuations that can suddenly, out of nowhere, create enough order that a brain, a human brain, might quickly pop up into existence and be conscious to see the world around it. And that's a Boltzmann brain. Yeah, I know. It's pretty weird. I admit that. But I don't really want to talk about Boltzmann's brain or a Boltzmann brain. I want to talk about a brain that really did exist. And that's Albert Einstein's brain. Now, I don't mean Albert Einstein as a human being, you know, with his smart guy. I mean his literal material brain, the clumps of gray matter that existed in his head. That's what I want to talk about, because there's some interesting things we could pull from this. Now, when Albert Einstein was alive, I mean, he was the most famous man alive, and everybody, they were obsessed with him. And when Einstein died, that obsession with him didn't die either. So great was the mania for anything Einstein that when he died, Einstein's brain was snatched out of his head like a walnut out of its shell. The brain that had for almost half a century that had dominated physics, you know, and disappeared like one of the subatomic particles that so fascinated him. And anyway, one rumor had it was that the organ had been cut into parts, and was stored in a garage in Saskatchewan next to hockey sticks and deflated basketballs. Another rumor was that some doctor at least had his eyes, that part of his brain, I guess eyes are technically part of our brain, and would bring them out at parties to show people. The truth, however, was a little more, well, kind of gruesome, but the doctor who did his autopsy on Einstein in 1955, Dr. Thomas Harvey, had opened up the corpse's skull and removed Einstein's brain, ostensibly for medical research. The only problem was the doctor took the brain and never returned it to. You know, Einstein's ophthalmologist supposedly got the eyes, but, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, someone said basically is that Harvey kept the brain for himself, not at the hospital, but at home. And when he was working at Princeton University, he simply took it with him. And according to what happened, he held on to the specimen for 40 years and doing little with it, but he'd dole out small pieces to people, a select few. Hey, you want a little clunk of Einstein? Yeah, I'll give you a present. What is it? Oh, it's a little clunk of Albert Einstein's brain. I don't know. But the point is, apparently, people knew he had the brain, and his medical practice kind of sank after that. I guess being a ghoul isn't a great career move. But anyway, he got old. He was in his 80s. And Harvey decided that he wanted to give the brain back to his family, to Einstein's family, which at that point meant an Einstein granddaughter living in Berkeley, California. Well, anyway, a journalist named Michael Paternetti, he had befriended Dr. Harvey and offered to drive him to the East Coast with his granddaughter to see his granddaughter. So you got one of the more strangest. So off they went. So the bottom line is off they went across the country in a Buick Skylark with Einstein's formaldehyde-soaked brain floating in a Tupperware container in the trunk. Now, Michael Paterni wrote a book called Driving Mr. Albert that recounted one of the more unexpected road trips in American history. An old guilty doctor, a journalist, and, of course, Albert Einstein's brain sloshing around in the trunk for about 3,000 miles, which, as you can imagine, caused quite a hoopla along the way when they told people about it. Now, I first heard about this. I read an article in Harper's Magazine. It was great. The article was great. After I read the article, I said, let me read the book. And the book was kind of boring. It was a good enough story for an article, not good enough for a book. But anyway, the most insightful part of this whole story, though, came toward the end of the trip when they met Einstein's perplexed granddaughter, Evelyn. I mean, she knew they were coming with her famous grandfather's brain, but, you know, okay, you're bringing my grandfather's brain. All right, great. What am I supposed to do with it? But anyway, at one point, Evelyn, Einstein, and Paterniti were sitting in the front seat of the Buick Skylark, and he opened the lid and showed her Grandpa Albert's brain. And Paterniti wrote the following. I lift the lid underneath a swash of damp cloth, and then maybe a dozen golf-side trunks of brain spill out. Parts of the cerebral cortex and the frontal lobe. The smell of formaldehyde smacks us like a backhand. The pieces are sealed in celluloid. The pinkish liver-covered blobs of brain rim by gold wax. I pick some out of the plastic container and hand a few to Evelyn. They feel squishy, weigh about the same as light beach stones. Then he goes on. She and Paternini pass the pieces back and forth for a few more moments. And then Evelyn, who remembered her grandfather very well, said the following. She looked up at Paternini and said, so, is this what all the fuss is about? A moment later, she fondled another piece and said, hey, you can make a nice necklace out of this one. Then calmly, quietly, they put the pieces back into the Tupperware container and closed the lid on Albert Einstein's brain. Now, I want you to put aside for a moment the weirdness of this scene, okay? I mean, here they are. They're sitting in a car with Albert Einstein's granddaughter in the car, and they're fondling parts of Albert Einstein's brain as if they were stolen jewels, okay? But yeah, but here they were, literally in their hands, holding in their hands the brain, these golf-sized chunks of brain matter, the place where the foundation of modern nuclear physics had been formulated. Somewhere right there, amid those pinkish liver-colored blobs, the formula E equals MC squared emerged, a formula that changed the world. Somewhere those little pieces of matter, no longer gray, they turned pink. Somewhere out of them came the theories of special and general relativity, which showed that time and space were not absolute, but changed depending on the amount of matter involved and depending on the speed of the observer. This is where we get the famous thought experiment, the twins, where you got one twin is, they're the same age, and one goes off in a rocket ship close to the speed of light, and comes back, you know, 10 years later, and the twin on the Earth is aged 10 years, but the twin in space only aged 2 because time slowed down when they went faster. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that. But this whole idea was formulated in these blobs of matter that they were looking at sitting in the front seat of the car. I guess the bottom line, in short, some of the most fascinating and valuable ideas were created within those few clumps of matter that they were fondling with their finger in the front seat of the Buick Skylark on that street in Berkeley, California. But, you know, the symbolism of this scene presents many possibilities. And I think one is, could Einstein, and all of his geniuses, all of his ideas, his passions. Yeah, Albert might have been a cold, calculating scientist, but he was a bit of a ladies' man, too. Could all this be limited to this brain matter, to those rills and crevices and neurons and fibers in their hands in the front seat of the car? Or could it even be limited by the entire physical structure of his whole body? I guess, is that in the end all Albert Einstein was? Is that in the end what all any of us really are? Purely physical beings living by purely physical laws alone and exuding emotions and creating art and ideas and creativity the way our stomach secretes peptic acid and the way the liver secretes bile? Are we and all that we do and think and create physical phenomena alone, the motions of atoms, the synthesis of proteins, the binding and activation of adenylate cyclase, the sequence of ACTH, alpha MSH, beta this, beta that, beta loperine, on and on and on? Is the question of how the wind will blow a leaf or whom will marry merely a different confluence of vectors? Could ideally everything about us, our thoughts, our desires, our choices, be explained and predicted the same way that we can explain and predict the motion of the stars? Well, you know, that's a tough question. And I think the answer to that really depends upon one major thing, and that is our origins, our precursors. How did we get here? And why? You know, if we are the products of purely physical forces within a purely and only physical universe, with nothing outside of matter in motion, nothing greater than matter in motion, nothing beyond matter in motion, then how can we be anything other than simply matter in motion? This view that we are totally physical processes alone, if this true, and a lot of people believe it's true, it means we have no more free will than a wind-up doll or a computer running a program. And though that's a topic for another talk, if what we are commonly taught about our origins, from the Big Bang to the Neo-Darwinian synthesis, is true, then where do we get the silly idea that we can actually have free choice? Where do we get the idea that we have free will? It's a silly notion if you work from that assumption, which is precisely why some people reject the notion of free will. There are a lot of smart people who have very good ideas for rejecting the concept of free will. Now, this gets rather sticky, the whole question of free will. And I think at some point I'm probably even going to do a program on that. But anyway, let's come back, though. Let's come back, though, again to this idea of, are we purely physical alone? Is there something else going on there? Are all your emotions, your passions, your feeling, everything, your creativity, is it just pre-programmed matter and motion following natural laws and you don't have a choice in any of it? Anyway, how many of you remember chemistry class in high school? Well, I can remember the class better than the chemistry, put it that way. But the one thing I remember, that's about all I got out of it, I flunked. But I remember the formula for water. Remember that? Everybody knows that. H2O, in which we were told by those who had never seen one, is two hydrogen atoms attached to an oxygen atom. Okay, fine. I'll take it on faith. But that assumption does lead to a question. You know, I don't know much about hydrogen atoms, and I don't know much about oxygen atoms, and I don't know much about the forces that bind them into the H2O entity itself. But you know what I'm going to guess? I would guess that not one of them are wet. The hydrogen atom ain't wet. The hydrogen atoms, the oxygen atoms, or the forces that bind them together, none of them are wet. I'd even go as far as to say a single H2O molecule is not wet. I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine how one hydrogen atom, whatever its configuration, as wet? I mean, a hydrogen atom wet? Or you put that, or two oxygen atoms, oxygen, as wet too? Okay, of course not. They are not wet. And you put them together, they make a single molecule, and that's not wet either. Okay, pretty simple. However, when enough of these non-wet entities are bunched up, they acquire an attribute that none of them have individually, and that is wetness. Now, somebody help me here. How do a bunch of dry things, when added together, become wet? Doesn't make sense, does it? Somehow, the whole is not only greater than the sum of the particles, the parts, but quantitatively different from the parts as well. That is, the whole takes on attributes not found in any or all of what creates it to begin with. I mean, almost think about piling up pennies. You pile up pennies, and the next thing you knew, they turn into an ATM machine dispensing $20 bills. Well, you know, there's a name for this. It's called emergence. And congratulations, because if you are listening to these words right now, then you are experiencing firsthand perhaps the most powerful manifestation of emergence known to humanity. I mean, after all, the stuff that you are made of is what? Well, you're made of the same stuff as Albert Einstein is. They say that we're really made of stardust. At one level, that's certainly right, because if you break all matter down, if you break it all down to its basic components, it's all still the same stuff. I mean, there really, we are told, only three particle matters and three forces. We're told there are electrons, which the atoms which are bound to the nucleus by electromagnetism. There's the nucleus of the atom, which is protons and neutrons bound together by the strong nuclear force. And lurking behind it all is good old gravity. Actually, the weakest of all the forces. Okay? Now, we could eat now. I guess it could get technically, you could get more fundamental. You get the thing like quarks, up quarks and down quarks and gluons. But for right now, we're fundamental enough. Neutrons and protons and electrons. And yet, when they... Now, as far as we all know about neutrons, protons, and electrons, and they do some pretty bizarre things. You watch, read a little about quantum physics, and it's a crazy world down there. But as far as anyone knows, protons, neutrons, and electrons cannot think or read as you can. Right? Right? I mean, that's, you know, capiche, okay? And yet, when they combine to form the atoms of which we... And when they combine to form the atoms of which we are made of, none of them can... These atoms can read either, right? Atoms read? Come on, come on, okay? Or listen, or whatever. And when those atoms merge into complex molecules that have nothing close to the consciousness that we are composed of, they have nothing like that, that nothing that we experience. There are, however, I will say this, though, there are some philosophers, I got to be fair, got to give it the due, there are some philosophers who argue that atoms and molecules and chemicals do have a certain amount of consciousness. That might be worth looking at that one day. And I guess on one level it makes some sense, but that's, and I guess if you believe it, it could help solve the dilemma I'm looking at now. But I think I could, most of us would agree that my assumption that molecules and atoms can't think, can't read, can't hear, I would think I could probably take most of you along with me that far. Okay, and then anyway, when these molecules become chemicals, swirling and swashing chemicals about in our brain cells, these chemicals can't read, can't listen, can't think, can they? Okay, what about carbon? We're all made of carbon. We're carbon-based life. Does carbon think? Or water? We're a carbon. Apparently, we're a bunch of carbon and a bunch of water. And or whatever the other chemicals we are made up of, one of them, which ones of them have consciousness? Which ones of them could think? And when those chemicals emerge into neurons in our brain, okay, can a neuron, a simple brain cell, think, have consciousness, and so on and so forth? Can experience love, hate, the color red, or any of the things that we do? Or can it read the words on your computer, or can they understand? If I laid a neuron out here, and I spoke to the neuron, okay, is it going to understand a thing I'm saying? And yet, here we are. Here you and I are at the end of the road, essentially a bunch of atoms and the few fundamental forces that hold the atoms together. And you're listening to these words and you're wondering perhaps, where's Goldstein going with all this? And well, simple. Goldstein's going here. If the current scientific understanding of reality is correct, then we have to believe, contrary to, if nothing else, common sense, that human consciousness needs no more ingredients than electrons, protons, neutrons, obeying the laws of physics. Because in the end, human consciousness is nothing but protons, electrons, and neutrons obeying the laws of physics. Okay. Now, I don't know, maybe I'm too simple, but somehow it just doesn't seem adequate. Somehow it almost seems like trying to explain Dvorak Slavonic dances by just studying acoustical engineering. You know, in contrast, the wonder of the biblical worldview is that this is the great thing about the biblical worldview. While it certainly incorporates all this physical stuff, even celebrates it, then God saw everything he made and it was very good. The biblical perspective isn't limited by it. In other words, the biblical perspective posits a dimension of reality far richer, far broader, and far deeper than the study of quarks and the color force that binds them alone can reveal, which might be help explain why so much of the physical world remains inexplicable to us, including not just the existence of conscious minds that can read and think, but maybe even why water is wet. You know, we can accept, we accept the physical worldview. We believe in it, obviously. But in the Bible, we're just not limited by it. That's all. We think there's much more to reality than just the physical. The natural world alone is not the only world out there. We believe in a reality greater than just the random motion of molecules. I mean, if the idea of our existence being explained as nothing but the random motion of molecules, if the idea of our existence being explained as nothing but the random motion of molecules of non-rational atoms, that seems about as adequate as love being explained as nothing but hormonal excretions. If so, then our origins must come to something greater than physical laws, something more than just matter in motion. There would have to be a power greater than the mechanical and physical forces that are part of, that run the universe. A power that not only created these laws, but along with them created human freedom. Our freedom, our creativity, and our capacity to love. Aspects of our existence that don't appear to be completely defined by those laws. Okay? In other words, I believe they're aspects of reality that just can't be explained by our understanding of quarks or protein molecules or even neurons. And what else could that power be? Again, I would argue, other than God, the Creator. As I said in another program, when it said that God was made in the image of man, this could mean things like, that man was made in the image of God, that this could mean that things like human freedom, creativity, and love are manifestations of the character of God Himself. Think about that. We could love. Scripture says God is love. In other words, when we love, we are expressing an image, a character of God Himself. In short, I'd say this. In the end, you think about it. Are we just matter in motion? Or if you sense there's more to it, then you really are on the right path.